Well, welcome to Marriage Matters and Rebuilders. We're so glad that you're here and honored that you've taken time out and carved time out of your schedules to be here for this workshop and hope that you'll get as much out of it as the people that have come before you. Some of you are probably surprised to walk in to this room and find out that there's actually two different workshops happening in the same room, both Marriage Matters and Rebuilders. And for those of you that don't know, Rebuilders is a workshop for people who have been through a divorce and are in the process of rebuilding their relational world following a divorce. And I'll explain a little bit more about how that came to be and why we're two workshops under one roof later in the evening. I'll tell you about that. Let me tell you about myself a little bit. My name is Gordy Smith, and I love teaching this. I've been a part of this from the very, very beginning. We've been doing Marriage Matters and Rebuilders for about 18 years now. And we started with Marriage Matters, and then about 2 years later, we added Rebuilders. And in that 18 years, about 5,000 people have gone through one of our 7 or 8 week workshops here in this room. And so you are among great company as you start into this process. A little bit about myself. I'm a pastor here at Heartland, and have been married to my wife Karen for about 35 years. Have two great sons, Tyler and Grayson. You'll hear me tell a bit more about kind of their stories and our family as you'll get to know them as we go through this process, because I'll tell you stories. I love doing this. I love teaching this. It's one of my favorite things that I get to do, but I will tell you that twice in the last 18 years, I have attempted to quit. And I remember literally sitting with the leadership team and saying, I need to not be teaching Marriage Matters anymore. And they said, well, why? And I said, well, just when I look at my own marriage, we've got stuff we need to work on. I mean, I love Karen, I love being married, but I'm in no position to be teaching other people how to have a healthy marriage. And they said, no, you must teach it. And I said, well, why? And they said, because we don't have anybody else. So here I am. I am not an expert on marriage. I haven't written any books about marriage. I've never even read any books on marriage, although I've had several read to me. Love teaching it, but I'm not at any level coming from, you know, being a marriage expert. I'm really just a kind of a fellow struggler. I'm somebody who loves my wife, loves being married, but we have discovered that it's a lot of work and it's hard at times. And so you're going to hear from me based more on that perspective of somebody who has been in this process the same as you have. So I'm glad that you're here. We're glad that you're here. I understand that in a room like this, you're here. There's a number of you that are here for a variety of reasons. Nobody comes from exactly the same place. We come from different places. Some of you have been to past workshops, and you decided to come back again, and that's great. We're glad that you're here. Some of you are just engaged, and you're using this as a way to prepare for marriage, and that's awesome. It's a great way to get ready for marriage. Some of you have been married for dozens and dozens of years, and so kind of on both ends of that marriage spectrum. Some of you have been planning to come for months. You've been looking forward to when we offered the workshop again and you signed up early. Some of you may have made just the decision to come today. Either you got the courage up or your schedule cleared. But whether you've been planning or whether this is kind of a last minute thing, we're glad that you're here and a part of it as well. Some of you have been really looking forward to this. And some of you on the other end of the spectrum would rather have a root canal without Novocaine to be here for a 7 week workshop. Some of you aren't really sure what you believe about God and the church, and so you're wondering what this is going to be like to come into a workshop that's put on by a church, and is something going to be shoved down your throat? Others of you, you know, maybe you've been a follower of Christ for years, and so you're excited to hear what Jesus and the Bible and God has to say about relationships and marriages from a biblical Christian perspective. Some of you here are near divorced, and you can look back at it honestly and realize that you were a cause of a lot of the challenges in marriage and even the things that led to the divorce. And some of you are here and you're divorced, but it was really your spouse, your ex-spouse, that kind of led to the problems that caused the divorce. Some of you are here and you're married, but honestly, your marriage is all but over. And maybe this is one last-ditch effort to see if there's any hope at all. Some of you, your marriage, you're here and your marriage is doing pretty well. And you know that it can always be doing a little bit better. And so you've come. And so wherever you are kind of on that spectrum, this is a good place to be. And I think you'll be glad that you came. Some of you are divorced and remarried. You're here on the Marriage Matters side, but this is not your first marriage. Some of you are divorced and single, and you're here in Rebuilders. Some of you are here by yourself. You're married, but for whatever reason, your spouse couldn't or didn't want to come, and so you're here by yourself. Some of you are here with your spouse. Some of you are living together and not married. Some of you are married and you're not currently living together. And let me just pause there for a second and speak to those of you that are here and you're living together but not married, because maybe you've come from the assumption or come in with the fear that we're going to kind of bash you on, down over the head with the idea that you're living in sin, those kind of things. We're not going to do that. We're glad that you're here, and we're not going to condemn you or cause you to feel guilty or anything like that. I will say that we what seemed to be like a really good idea for you at the time, you've discovered that living together has a set of challenges of its own, and we're not here to judge you. We're glad that you're here. I will say that we believe that living together and not being married is not God's highest and best for you, that God has a plan for you that is even better than what you're experiencing now. But wherever you are on this continuum or any of those continuums, we're glad that you're here. The one thing that we all have in common is that I believe we have all discovered that relationships don't come easy, and they bring more pain than we ever thought that they would. I remember when Karen and I got married a number of years ago, you know, we were so in love, and we were Christ followers, and so we wanted to have a God-centered marriage from the very beginning. And people had told us, you know, marriage is hard, you're going to have to do a lot of work, and we understood that. We said, yeah, but somehow it felt like it was different for us, because we were so in love. We thought somehow that's going to be, we won't experience that like other people have experienced it. So we got married, and boy, were we surprised. And I remember early on in our marriage, we moved to Peoria, and we were in a great church there and had a bunch of other young couples our age that we were friends with. And it always seemed to us, because we were a few years into it, we were really struggling. And a few years into it, we noticed that all the people that we hung out with, they all seemed like they were doing just fine. And we'd go out to eat with them. We were in a small group, and everybody seemed, and so it made it even, you know, more glaringly apparent to us that something was wrong with us. And we would come home and go, "What's wrong with us? Everybody else seems to be doing just fine." And then I remember one time we got into a discussion, and somebody made the observation about us that they were struggling in their marriage with some things, but it always appeared to them like we were doing just fine. And we began to realize that we put on kind of that, you know, public expression of who we were when we were with people as well. And we found out that the challenges and the problems that we were experiencing in our marriage were not unique to us. A lot of other people were experiencing the same thing. One time my wife and I went to a marriage conference by Dan Allender, who's an author and one of my favorite teachers and authors. And it was, you know, no kind of lights, bells, and buzzers. It was just Dan Allender in a stool, on a stool, on a stage with some chairs set up. And he started the whole seminar, a weekend workshop. He sits on the stool with a microphone and starts it this way. He says, "No one has shown me more of what hell will be like than my wife." And we all chuckled like you're chuckling. And then he said, "And no one has given me more of a taste of what heaven will be like than my wife." And Karen and I looked at each other and went, I could listen to this guy all day. That's our story. This is a guy who gets us and gets our marriage. And so we realized that God has made us for relationships. The one thing that's unique about people over any other animal in the animal kingdom is that God has made us to be relational beings. That to get the most out of our one and only life is to do life in the context of relationship. With marriage being at the pinnacle of all human relationships, God has created marriage to be the most intense, the most sacred, the most intimate of all human relationships. And in that, we experience great joy in our marriage. For most people, more joy in our marriage than we experience anywhere else. And yet at the same time, we often experience as much pain or more pain in our marriages as we do anywhere else, just because of that kind of intensity experience in our marriages. So I believe all of us entered into marriage knowing it's going to be challenging, but somehow thinking it would be different for us. You know, we love this person more than any person that we've ever loved on the planet. We want to spend the rest of our lives with them. And then something happens to change that perspective. we get married. And then life begins to happen and marriage begins to happen. And some of you find yourself at a place now that you never thought you would get to, and that is wondering if there's any hope for your marriage. My hope for all of us, whether you're married or not, even those of you that are here divorced, is when we think back on the day that we were married, think of the hope that we had that day. Hope that life was, what marriage was going to bring us and what life was going to bring us as a result of that marriage. Was that just a fantasy that day? What I want to say is no, it wasn't. It was a very real hope. And my desire is to reinstill some of that hope in you through this workshop. And to remember and even recapture some of those feelings that we started the relationship with. And so my number one desire for you in this whole 7-week workshop is that you would leave here with more hope than when you came in, for yourself, maybe for your marriage, for your relationships, that there is something about hope that helps us keep going forward and keep moving in positive directions. So, if you're here and you're engaged, I mentioned some of you are probably here and engaged, and you already have lots of hope, and that's great. You just need to know we are not looking at you thinking, wait till you find out what it's really like. No. We know that you have hope, and that's a great thing. If we want to do anything, it's to help solidify that hope and give you some tools so that when you encounter the things in marriage that most people encounter, you will have the tools to work through those and to make your marriage more healthy and better. Okay. So what I want to do tonight is I want to start by sharing some principles and growth to healing. Some principles to healing and growth. Because wherever you are on those spectrums that we talk about, all of us, some of you come and you need healing in your relationship and personally. Some of you are just wanting to grow more. But tonight we're going to talk about how we begin that process. Because interestingly, the principles for healing and growth are the same for each one. And so what I want to do is start by talking about the four basic principles for healing and growth that will set the platform for where we go through this entire workshop. The first is this: healing and growth take time. Healing and growth take time. Relationships bring pain, and that takes time. You didn't get here quickly. If you're here and you're struggling and you're in pain, you didn't get here quickly, and you can't be fixed quickly. I remember the first time, and by the way, Karen and I have been in and out of marriage counseling on and off for most of our married life, and so I'm a great proponent of marriage counseling. It's been extremely helpful to us, and I would encourage that wherever it might be helpful for you. I remember the very first time we went to a marriage counselor, and there was some stuff that we were struggling with, and we couldn't resolve it ourselves, and we decided maybe we should get some help, and so we went to a counselor. And I remember going, first of all, knowing that it wasn't cheap, and also, you know, we're going to be with this guy for an entire hour. And I was absolutely convinced that it was going to be like a one and done. Like, we're going to go for an hour, and then that will be it, because he'll be able to, as we're talking, he'll be able to discern and assess the things that Karen needs to do differently and how she's caused the problems that we have. And then he would set that stuff straight, and then we would go home and everything would be better. And apparently, I had some things I needed to work on too. And so that really began a process for us of looking at some of the challenges in our marriages and in our marriage and in our relationship and how we both needed to work at that, and it was going to take some time. And so in that, the three steps that I must take in healing and growth are, number one, I must be aware of the dance. I must be aware of the dance. You know, we each get into different patterns in our relationship that are destructive, and we all have different dances. None of our marriages are what we thought and hoped that they would be, right? I remember several years ago, Karen and I, one of the things that Karen and I have done is that every house that we've ever lived in, and where I think we're in our fourth house now, is that we've bought a house that needed a lot of work, and we've fixed it up. We love older houses and keeping the character and nature of those houses. And the house that we live in right now was a house that was built in the 50s, but the people that had built the house had torn down this old wooden house that was built in like the late 1800s and had all kinds of inlaid wood floors and just these beautiful woodwork floors. And they tore as much stuff out of that house as they could and then incorporated it into the house that they built that we now live in. And so we love it. And so one of the things that we discovered is that in our garage attic was a bunch of the stack of flooring that was left over from the original house. And it was all this beautiful inlaid variety of woods, just gorgeous flooring from the 1800s. And so we were excited about that and thought, you know, someday we're going to use that. And then we were in a project where we were redoing our bedroom. And we were, one of the things that you'll kind of hear as we go through this is that one of our challenges has been that my wife's health for the last 25 years has been going downhill. She's got some chronic illnesses, and that's just been a factor for us to walk through as a family. And so we decided it would be better for us to have our bedroom on the main floor. And so that when she's wasn't feeling well, that she would still be in the main flow of our family. And so we moved our master bedroom to the main floor, did some remodeling, and there was this little like entryway into our bedroom that we had to redo the floor. And we said this would be the perfect place for that inlaid flooring from the old house. And so we were so excited for that. Well, shortly before we got to that part of the project where we would need that wood, sleeping one night and woke up in the middle of the night, probably about 1 in the morning, to this pounding, the ringing of our doorbell and this pounding of our door. It's kind of frightened me out of a sleep, and I went down and looked, and I opened the front door, and here was our next door neighbor standing on the front door with this kind of eyes about this big around, and he said, "Get out, your house is on fire," which, you know, was the words you hope you never hear. But I ran back, and I got Karen up and got the kids up, and we got outside and saw that it was getting close to winter. And during the summer, just because we had kids, you may have done this before, where we only put one car in the garage during the summer because we need space for the bikes and that other equipment like that. But in winter, we hang it all up and we get both cars in the garage. So we weren't quite to that place yet. So Karen's car was in the garage. My car was parked outside the garage, very close to the garage door. And somehow, my car in the middle of the night had spontaneously combusted. The engine just started on fire. And this is what was amazing. No doubt in my mind, it was God's intervention. But next door, the other couple, our neighbors were sleeping, and our neighbor lady woke up in the middle of the night. And she didn't smell anything. Their windows were closed. Didn't hear anything. She sensed something was wrong. And she went to the window and looked out and saw my car on fire. The fire had just started in my car. And so she yelled to her husband, "Go get the Smiths out of bed. Their house is on fire." And while he was doing that, she called 911. And while she was talking to 911, she saw the fire build in my car. And it burned through the garage door, started the garage door on fire. Eventually started my wife's car on fire, so we lost both of our cars. And then the fire went up the side of the garage and into the vents at the peak of the garage door, at the peak of the garage, and then started into our garage attic and began burning through our garage attic. Now, our house wasn't, I guess code was different back then. There was no firewall between our garage and the rest of the house. So the fire was burning quickly towards the main part of the house. And right on the other side of that wall was my boy's bedroom. And so we all got out okay. It was a miracle. But by the time, you know, the fire department got there and put everything out. But it was some pretty extensive damage. But had it, you know, had she not woken up and had she, you know, they not gotten us out of the house, that fire easily could have gone through and at least killed both of my boys, probably taken down the house and maybe probably killed both of us at the process. So we were very, very thankful, okay? It was a miracle. Now, it was a mess to clean up. And so we had a restoration company come in, and they cleaned out all the stuff that was, you know, charred and left over in the garage, and they took it to a warehouse. And then after we had, you know, gotten all the repairs done, before they were, you know, getting ready to close, they called me one day, and they said, you know, "We're about ready to be completely done with your project. There's a bunch of stuff here at the warehouse that I don't know if any of it's salvageable. You might want to come and look through it. Just to see if there's anything of sentimental value that you want to keep." I said, "Yeah, I think that's a great idea." So I went, and there was a few things here and there. I went, "Yeah, we'll keep that. We'll take that back. We can still use that." And then I saw laying on the floor and bundled that stack of flooring, wood, old, 100-year-old wood that was dry and, you know, probably should have just been like kindling and exploded in the fire, but it was untouched by the fire. And I remember going back home and telling her. Now, it had been enough, you know, time lapse since then. We were absolutely sure we had lost that wood in the fire, and so we had to make other arrangements in the meantime for that flooring for our new bedroom. And I remember when I told Karen about that wood and took it home, her first response was, she said, "It makes me sick to my stomach to think that we could have used that wood, and we ended up using new wood that we don't like." You know, it just makes me sick. It just really, really bothered her that we weren't able to use that wood when we had made it. And my reaction was more, "Oh well, you know, stuff happens." And that's kind of the family that I grew up in, was always like, you know, keep a positive attitude about everything, even when bad stuff happens. And so it really, really bothered her. But for me, it was more like, oh, well, let's just, you know, move on as if nothing happened. And you know, she wants to process her feelings and talk about it. I want to, you know, just say, you know, I don't want to talk about it. Let's just move on. And that's the dance that we get into. And it continues. And that was several years ago. But then just, you know, even recently, you know, this we had this past winter, we had this really, really cold, bitter winter that we lost. We had done a lot of landscaping in our yard. We had bushes and shrubs and trees that we had planted like 20 years or 15 years ago. So they're now finally looking like where we hoped that they would look at some point. And we had a lot of those get some severe freeze damage. And we lost huge parts of the tree. Some of them we lost a whole tree and bushes and things like that. And again, that it made Karen sick to her stomach. She just said, it just bothers me so much that we did all of that and we finally get it where we want it, and here this cold winter comes and destroys so much of it. And my reaction was, you know, oh well, you know, we'll plant new ones. That's just what we're going to do. And so that's our dance. Our dance just kind of continues, and our dance goes on. And so the question is, are you aware of your dance? What's the dance that you get into in your marriage or past marriage? The second principle, or the second step I need to take, is that I must acknowledge my part of the dance. I need to be aware of my part of the dance, but then I need to acknowledge my part of the dance. I need to stop focusing my attention on my spouse or my ex-spouse as the cause of my problems or the cause of our relational problems. You know, my guess is if you're here as a couple, well, one of you is more primarily the dragger, and one is the draggee, and we can tell because the heel marks on the carpet, you know, all the way to your table. If that's true for you, the dragger is probably thinking, "I dragged you here because there's things you need to work on." And what I want to do for a minute is look at a familiar story for a lot of you, an encounter that Jesus has in Luke 6 with some of the Pharisees, some of the religious leaders of the time. And Jesus says this. He says, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your own, in the other person's eye, and pay no attention to the log in your own eye?" So he says, okay, so why do you pay attention to the, you know, the speck in somebody else's eye while there's a log in your own? So kind of this humorous picture of somebody walking around with a log sticking out of their eye. He says, how can you say, "Let me take the speck out of your eye," when you fail to see the log in your own eye? Okay, so clearly Jesus is making a comparison here. One of you has the speck and one of you has a log, and he's relating it to conflict. So when you find yourself in conflict, he's saying one of you has the speck and one of you has the log. And so the question is, who's the bigger contributor to the conflict, to the problem that we have? And we all do that same comparison, don't we? So when we're in conflict in our marriages and relationships, we all tend to ask ourselves the question, who's more at fault here? And to be really honest, just because of my own sinful, broken nature, it always feels like Karen is more the contributor to the problem than I am. And that's just kind of the nature of who we are. And so let's face it, when we look at relational problems, it's usually the other person who has the log, right? But what about a major problem? You know, what if it's more obvious, you know, who's more at fault here? So what if I had an affair in my marriage? Now who's got the log? Well, clearly I do, okay? What if my wife had an affair? Now who has the log in their eye? Well, clearly she does, right? But it's not a comparison. Jesus is not saying, you know, look at you, you're worse than they are. He's not saying every time something goes wrong, it's always your fault. And he's not saying, now the goal is when you get into conflict, figure out which one of you has the speck and which one of you has the log. Figure out who's more at fault. He's talking here about perspective. And he's actually talking to a large group of people and saying to all of them, you should approach all conflict as if you're the one with the log. Jesus is saying, I should approach all conflict as if I'm the one with the log in my eye. And if I've got a log in my eye, I clearly need to first deal with that before I'm ever able to, you know, help somebody else with a speck in their eye. And so I need to acknowledge my part and deal with my part and my own stuff. And so from Jesus' perspective, if I had an affair, who's got the log? Well, I do. If my wife had an affair, now who's got the log? Well, I do. And some of you are going, whoa, whoa, whoa. That doesn't mean, she doesn't need to be responsible for her, what she did, which was, you know, absolutely wrong. But it's saying from my perspective, the very first thing I need to do is I need to look at what was my part. What was the environment that I created in my marriage in which she made a really bad decision? It doesn't mean I'm responsible for her decision or it's my fault, but it says the first thing I have to do is I have to acknowledge my part of the dance. What did I contribute? What could I have done differently? All right? And so the question is, can I acknowledge my part? Can I resist the temptation to blame? Can I own my own part and look at what I need to do differently? Okay? And some of you are here by yourself. Some of you are married, as I said, but you came by yourself because your spouse couldn't or wouldn't. And you're wondering if it will do any good because you're thinking about them and thinking they're the ones that really have some work to do. Well, the reality is it only takes one person to change the dance. So yes, you being here and you working on your stuff could make a huge difference. And we see that all the time. And isn't it true, we get stuck in this rut in our relationships and in our marriages where we say, you know, if you would change, I would change too. You know, I understand, I got stuff I need to work on, but if you would change, I would change too. You know, one person says, hey, you know, would you quit nagging me? And the other person says, you know, if you would do more around here, I wouldn't nag so much. You know, and the other person says, well, if you wouldn't nag so much, I might do more around here. This idea that it's got to start with you. You know, it feels like we never have sex anymore. Well, if you would be willing to just, you know, go for walks and hold hands with me once in a while, we might have more sex around here. Well, if we had more sex around here, I might want to be willing to go for more walks and hold each other's hands. So we recognize that we have stuff to work on, but we always assume it's got to start with the other person. And then I hear that line, I hear people say, you know, the sense of, you know, well, I know I'm not perfect, but... And usually when we start a sentence, I know I'm not perfect, we're about to tell you how, you know, like I'm falsely, you know, owning my own stuff, but the real problem is somebody else. I know I'm not perfect, but, and it's a really, really big but, okay? And you may be here thinking, I know I've got stuff to work on, but it's the other person. And that's why Jesus told this story and challenged those leaders that way. Now, for those of you that are here in Rebuilders, you're probably wondering, this seems like a marriage conversation, and I'm divorced, and how is that possibly helpful for me? We discovered years ago, and through some great counsel from a psychologist named Dr. Jan Hook, that one of the challenges for people that have been through a divorce, one of the common struggles for people that have been through a divorce. Now, when you go through a divorce, and those of you who have been through that, you understand that in the initial season right after the divorce, there's just a lot of pain. And you're walking through some muck trying to figure out how to, you know, navigate life in this new realm financially and relationally and everything else. And so you generally surround yourself, understandably, with a group of people who are for you, kind of your people, who kind of hold you up and help you in that, okay? But one of the things, and then you get, you know, kind of get your feet back on the ground. But one of the things most people who have never been divorced do is to go back and look at the marriage that failed and ask themselves the question, what can I learn about the marriage that failed? what do I need to own and what do I need to do differently in the future? Because the reality is statistics tell us that 67% of those of you that have been divorced will be remarried at some point, and many of you others will be in significant relationships. And if you don't go back and wrestle with and deal with the mistakes that were made in the first marriage, you will make those exact same mistakes in the next relationship. And we know that. And we understand that that group of people that are for you surrounding your divorce are probably not challenging you in that area. And that's okay. I get that. But we're here to help you do that. And so there's the stage of grief following the divorce, where you're mourning the loss of the relationship, of the hope, of the dream, and then you begin rebuilding your life and your relationships, okay? And so you're here to look at what you can learn about the marriage that failed. And so as we talk about these same topics, you'll have a different set of questions for your small group, but we're going to look at the same topics that people in Marriage Matters do, but all with the eye of looking back at the marriage that failed. And some of you, that will be really, really painful, and I understand that. And we're not here to dredge up bad feelings and pain, but we're here to work on our own stuff. And so I'll just tell you this. Those of you here in Rebuilders and have been through a divorce, we understand that in the marriage that failed, you both have a pile of stuff that contributed to the downfall of the marriage. And granted, your ex-spouse's pile may be huge compared to yours in terms of what the contribution was to the downfall of the marriage. But we just don't care. And I know that sounds harsh, but what I'm saying is we're not here to talk about their pile. Even if it's, you know, 10 times bigger than your pile, we're here to talk about your stuff and what you can learn about who you were in the marriage and who you are moving forward. And so whether you're here in Marriage Matters or Rebuilders, we're each here to work on our own stuff. We're here to take the same topics and work on our own stuff. That's why we do both workshops in the same room. We're all doing the same thing. And those of you that have been married, you probably remember that the most common marriage advice you've ever heard is remember, and people probably, your aunt probably told you this at your wedding or wrote it in your card, remember marriage is a 50-50 proposition. And we live that way, you know, with this idea that it's a 50-50 deal. Well, here's the challenge with thinking of marriage as a 50-50 deal. If I think of my marriage as a 50-50 relationship, I kind of view it in this idea of it being a scale. And whose, you know, whose contribution is kind of lagging a little bit. And again, just because of my own broken, sinful nature, if I view my marriage as a scale, it sometimes always seems like I'm doing more than my part. Like Karen's not holding up her end of the bargain and doing as much as she should be doing. And so that gets us into trouble. And so what I want to tell you is the people that have told you that marriage is a 50-50 relationship, they meant well, but it's really bad advice. Marriage is not a 50-50 relationship. Marriage is a 100% proposition. God doesn't call me to look at my marriage. In fact, you know, I remember one time looking in my Bible to find out where it says that marriage is a 50-50 proposition, marriage relationship, because I wanted to show Karen and say, see, right here it says 50-50, come on. And it's not there. Here's what the Bible says. Marriage is a 100% relationship. God calls me to be 100% of the man and the husband that he's created me to be, regardless of how Karen is doing at the time, regardless of whether I think she's holding up her end of the bargain or contributing as much to the marriage as I am. Men, God has called you to be 100% of the husband and the man that he's created you to be, regardless of how your wife is doing at the time or whether you feel like she's contributing. And ladies, God has called you to be 100% of the wife and the woman that he's designed you to be, even if you feel like in that moment you're doing more than your share. Marriage is a 100% proposition. And I often hear people saying, you know, well, yeah, in a marriage, well, what about me? I'm not getting, you know, as much out of this marriage. I remember one time when our boys were younger, and I was, I think I was taking the boys, two are from school, I can't remember what the arrangement was, but both boys were in the back seat, Grayson, our youngest, was still in a car seat or a booster, and we're driving along, And all of a sudden, I just hear screaming and yelling and crying and hitting. And I look in the rearview mirror, and it looks like a cartoon, you know, with the hands going everywhere and the dust flying. And I kind of glance back and go, what is going on back there? And I hear them yelling, and Tyler says, he hit me. And Grayson said, he took my Game Boy. And Tyler says, because he hit me, you know. And I did something then that I have never done before. But if you're a parent, I highly recommend this. All the times that you've threatened to pull over if they don't stop, I pulled over. I pulled over. I put the car in park. It got real quiet in the backseat. And I turned around, and I said, what's going on? And Tyler said, he hit me. And Grayson said, he took my Game Boy. And I looked at Grayson, and I said, did you hit him? And he goes, well, he did. I said, I don't care what he did. Did you hit him? He took my Game Boy. Grayson, I don't care what he did. You never hit your brother. There is never a good reason to hit your brother. Do you understand me? Yes. And out of the corner of my eye, I see Tyler, and he's kind of grinning, and I think he's going, this is good. I like this. And then I turn to Tyler. I said, did you take his Game Boy? Tyler goes, it's not his Game Boy. It's my Game Boy. I took it. I said, did you take it out of his hands? Yes. I said, you don't ever grab something out of somebody's hands. I don't care if it belongs to you or not. You never grab something out of somebody's hands. Do you understand me? Yes. You see, what I needed for those boys in that moment was to realize it doesn't matter what the other person has done. You're responsible for your own behavior. And you need to look at your own behavior somewhat in isolation and say, what did I do? What should I have done differently? And it's the same for us in marriage. Marriage is not a 50-50 relationship, and we need to acknowledge our part of the dance. And then letter C, I must change my part of the dance. New patterns of thinking and feeling and relating need to be established. I need to recognize and accept the fact that I cannot change my spouse. I cannot change Karen. I can only change myself. I go back to that first counseling experience. I fully expected that I was paying a counselor to fix Karen and to change her in the ways that I felt like she needed to change for our marriage to be better. But I come to the realization, and we start this whole workshop with this understanding, you can't change anybody else. The only person you can change is yourself. And so then the second basic principle of healing and growth is that healing and growth happen best in community. Look at what 2 Corinthians says. It says, God comes alongside us when we go through hard times, and before you know it, he brings us alongside someone else who is going through hard times so that we can be there for that person, just as God was there for us. One of the things that I hope that you'll discover in this workshop and in this process, and probably especially around your tables, is that you're not alone. One of the comments that I hear most often from the discussions at the tables is people, you know, having the courage to share something about their story and totally assuming that their situation is so unique that everybody's going to stare at them like, what's wrong with you, or laugh at them. And as soon as they share something, somebody else says, you too? Because I've struggled with that exact same thing. And people come out of here realizing that they're not alone, that God brings other people alongside of us for this part of the journey. In fact, Matthew 18, Jesus says, wherever two or three come together in my name, there I am in your midst. And I hope you experience that in your small groups. God says when we gather, he's there in our midst. And I hope that in this process, whether you have known Jesus for a long time or don't, I'm not even sure what you believe, that you will experience an expression of Jesus in your small group that maybe you haven't before. And it may just come through the acceptance and grace in your small groups. And so I'll tell you a little bit more about small groups at the end, but we're going to spend some time every week looking at one of the topics that we struggle with in relationships and topics that can help us, and then we're going to spend some time after that just discussing that in small groups. And I will tell you this, these are not therapy sessions, okay? Your table facilitators are not counselors. They're here to keep, we're going to have a discussion, and their job is to keep the discussion going. And my hope for you is that in the small group, you will begin to tell your story and that you'll hear parts of other people's stories. At whatever level you feel comfortable, we're not going to push you to start revealing stuff that you don't feel comfortable revealing. It's not that at all. It's for you to begin sharing whatever level of your story that you feel comfortable sharing. And then maybe to push that comfort zone a little bit every week as the time goes on. And I think that you will come to appreciate your small group discussion, even if you're somebody that kind of isn't excited about being in a small group right now, that you will actually find that to be the most helpful and the best part of our time together. Because I think we all have fears and apprehensions about being in small groups. I mean, I'm the one that put this together, and yet when I go places and they say we're now going to, split into small groups, there's a part of me that just goes, just shoot me, because I'm not. So I kind of reluctantly enter into small group experiences. But then at the end of those, I always walk away and go, that was really good. And my hope is, regardless of how you're feeling right now, that that will be how your experience is in the small group. And so I'm going to encourage all of you. Each of your tables has a facilitator, but I'm going to charge you at the tables to really work hard to make your table a safe place for everybody at the table. And that starts by being appropriate in your sharing. And so if you're here as a couple, be really careful not to share something that you need to have the permission of your spouse before you decide if we're going to share this or not. It wouldn't be appropriate to say at your table, well, he had an affair, if that wasn't something that you were in agreement about talking about. It's also not a good place to, your table is not a place to have a confession at your table, because somehow there's safety in that, to say, well, I've never even told my husband this, but I had an affair. That would not be an appropriate thing. So really work at keeping your table safe. And then I would also challenge you to not share something at your table and share it in a way that you really, we can tell that you're doing it and you're doing it, you know that you're doing it, to try and gain support for your side of the story. I mean, think about this. How much would you respect somebody if they, at your table, if they didn't spin the story, to kind of make them look better or spin it in their favor, but they actually came out and said, and, to be really honest, this was my fault. I think our respect for that person would go way up. So own stuff, share your story, be appropriate. And then at the end of your notes, you see that we added a thing that we call table manners. And it was just some of the rules. I grew up in a family, I don't know about you, but I grew up in a family that we had dinner together every night. And I know that doesn't happen very often anymore. And then we had Sunday dinner around the dining room table every week. And we had table manners. There were things that we could and couldn't do at the table. Things like no elbows on the table, no reaching for something, always ask for things to be passed, those kinds of things. And so we thought about the tables here and in our small groups. And so we just came up with some things that we thought these would be helpful for us to kind of agree to together to say these are going to be our table manners. And you can see the list. I won't go through all of them. We start with a 3-minute rule that says, if you're sharing part of your story and you go beyond 3 minutes, not only does that cut into everybody else's time, but the reality is you've probably gone that long because you're rambling and not really sure where to, stop your talking. And so we're gonna lovingly say to you, hey, remember the 3-minute rule that Gordy talked about? We're not saying we don't want to hear you. We're not saying we don't want you to share anymore, so don't take it that way. But we just need to be able to move on and hear from some other people. Don't give advice. And men, I'll tell you, this is huge for us because we tend to be advice givers and fixers. And so really fight the temptation. When you're hearing somebody say, here's a challenge that I've got, and your mind is immediately going, well, I know what you should do. Don't say anything. Don't say that, okay? So don't give your opinion. Don't give advice. If anything, just talk about maybe a similar experience that you had. Talk about something that you can relate to rather than trying to fix the people at your table. And then, of course, honor confidentiality. I would hope that would go without saying, but one of the things that will make your table safe is when people have the assurance that when they share something, even when they share something and they start to feel a little uncomfortable because they're not sure they should have shared that much, but they know that the table is not going to share that anywhere outside of this room. And so that creates safety. And it's also the thing that can destroy safety is quicker than anything else is when we don't honor confidentiality. So that you can go over those with your table before you, when you get into the discussion tonight, but those table manners we have found to be really, really helpful. And then the third principle of healing and growth is that healing and growth are intentional work. Healing and growth are intentional work. We never drift towards positive changes in our life. You ever notice that? We don't drift towards eating better. you know, if you're somebody that has not eaten well, suddenly you don't go, I don't know how this happened, but suddenly I find myself eating salads and chicken breasts, and I don't know when that happened. You know, I've got a little weight machine in my basement, and so I work out when I can, and especially through the winter. But I've never had this experience. I've never been sitting at the bench press station on my weight machine in my basement and thought, how did I get here? Because just a few minutes ago, I was watching TV and eating donuts, and next thing I know, I'm down here. No, we never drift into positive changes. The positive changes in our life are always intentional. Nobody has ever quit smoking by, you know, suddenly going, I don't think I've had a cigarette in about 2 months. Huh. Apparently, I've quit smoking. No, all those changes have to be intentional. And that's true with being a better dad or a better mom. It's true for being a better husband, a better wife, is that those all take intentional effort and decisions and then choosing to do things differently. And that's true when it comes to healing and growth in our marriages as well. And again, you can only be intentional about yourself. You can't be intentional about changes that somebody else needs to make. Look at what Galatians 6 says. Paul writes, each one of us should test his own actions. Then he can take pride in himself without comparing himself to someone else. For each one should carry his own load. And that's what I'm saying. When it comes to this process of healing and growth, we need to each carry our own load and not assume that it's our job to get somebody else to do something with their load. And then finally, the fourth principle of healing and growth is that healing and growth are the work of God. God is the ultimate healer. And some of you, you know, you came in here and you've been a follower of Christ for years, and so you're kind of excited to hear what the Bible has to say and what God has to say about marriage and relationships. And some of you aren't sure what you believe. You're not even sure if you believe that the Bible is true or if there is a God. And if that's the case for you, I just want you to know we're glad that you're here. And I promise you, we are not going to beat you over the head with the Bible and shove anything down your throat. I will say this. I hope that you come with an open mind. Because whether you believe in the Bible or believe in God or not, I can tell you this. This book is full of great advice for marriages and for relationships. And so we're going to look at some of what this book has to say, what I believe God has to say about your one and only life and how he wants you to get the very most out of your relationships. Because even if you're not a follower of God, I know this about God. He loves you, he wants the best for you, and he wants the best for your marriage, whether you're following him or not. And I hear people say, you know, well, what's the secret to a good marriage? What's the secret to a great marriage? You need to know this. There is no secret. God wants you to have a good marriage, and he doesn't keep it secret. He tells us how to have great relationships and how to have great marriages. And so we're going to look at that together. John 3:16, the most famous, familiar verse in all of the Bible, says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. He gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. God wants you to get the very most out of your one and only life. And it holds true especially in this area of marriage and relationships. And so next week, we're going to take kind of a deeper dive into God's view of marriage. We're going to look actually at how God intended marriage to be in the first place, and then look at what happened that kind of brought, when brokenness kind of entered the picture and resulted in some of the pain and stress that you and I feel and experience in our relationships and in our marriages today. So thanks for being with us. I'm going to send you to your small groups now, and your leaders will tell you more. You've got the questions there. But thanks so much for being a part of Marriage Matters and Rebuilders, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next time.